Hello and welcome to The Dorothy Project, the interview podcast celebrating women's impact on queer culture. My name's Alice Beverton-Palmer, and this week I am fully indulging my nerdy side by peppering a historian with questions. Dr. Fern Riddell is a historian, podcaster, and the author of, among others, the brilliant book Sex: Lessons from History. If you haven't read it yet, basically its fairly revolutionary perspective is that not only have people always been obsessed with sex, but the British people in the past weren't necessarily as narrow-minded about sex, sexuality, and gender as you might think, which I found a really hopeful message. But I'll let Dr. Riddell tell you more in her own words.
The Dorothy Project with Alice Beverton-Palmer.
Your new book, Sex: Lessons from History, is a wide-ranging history of sex and the culture around it. Having previously written about suffragettes and about Victorian culture, like when it came to taking on a broader sweep through history, why did you choose sex?
It's funny, the suffragettes isn't actually separated from sex at all, because Death in 10 Minutes, which was my previous book, is a biography of Kitty Marion, who was a suffragette bomber and then became a birth control campaigner. So that kind of thread between women fighting for female rights and how combined that is with sex is one I always found really fascinating. But I think a lot of the time when you look at that history, it's just victimhood, like it's how terrible the past was for women and sex and all of this. And actually the reality is very different, especially in the Victorian era. A woman who features in both a little bit in Death in 10 Minutes and then massively in my new book, Sex Lessons, is Annie Besant, who in 1877 fought for us, went to court and stood up in court to make sure women had the right to access not just birth control, but sex ed information. So how to have great sex and why it matters and how much fun it can be. And I think finding those stories in the past is something I'm a real fan of, and I love to do, because I like anything that challenges kind of the sanitized history or the history we were taught when we were kids, because that's a lot of people's kind of basic historical line, and you don't get told the good bits when you're in school.
Did you grow up in the UK?
I did, yeah. I grew up in a tiny little village just outside of Canterbury. And I think also slightly coming from a rural, from an absolutely rural background in kind of deep country and farms and everything else, you are introduced to what sex is in animals, in the animal kingdom, very quickly. And you've got questions because you're small. And I think I was incredibly lucky to really grow up in a family, in a house where sex wasn't seen and there's something that was shameful, and that the most important thing, especially when I hit puberty, was that you explore what feels good to you and you have the tools to be able to say to whatever partner you're with, that feels good to me or that doesn't. So I think when I was a teenager, I was really lucky to grow up in such a kind of healthy atmosphere about sex that was questioning and was not shaming in any way. When I went to university, I suddenly realized that was really unique. And a lot of people, the majority of my friends, did not grow up with that kind of dialogue with their family, didn't grow up with that kind of support, I guess, in many ways. I do have to say, just because I had that doesn't mean that I had amazing sex or great kind of sexual partners or anything. I messed up and I had a lot of problems, and I found difficult dialogues and, you know, abusive relationships and all that as I got older. But I think I was really lucky when I was younger to have had such positive messages growing up, because I think, you know, especially from conversations with friends, the amount of shame that can be introduced around sex very early on is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting as well, because, you know, I was thinking of this in a framing of school and Section 28. And obviously that's cast a very long shadow. But you're right that what gets said at home is so crucial, especially when it was illegal to talk about this stuff in schools. So how do you think this should be taught. And it's interesting as well the way you say about someone fighting for this in the Victorian era, and yet it's still being so difficult, you know, well over 100 years later.
Yeah, I think that the most, you know, when you talk to teachers, especially people who are teaching history, there's a real desire to make sure kids are getting the most important information. And I have a huge amount of respect. I have a huge amount of respect for history teachers. But I do think our guidelines on around what the government says you should teach is absolutely out of touch with what kids are getting in their wider communities.
The thing that I'm really sad about is, like, so I was a teenager in, like, at the turn of the century, so like late 90s, early noughties, and I bought every single teenage girls magazine. I used to buy Bliss, Sugar, J17, and the thing that makes me really worried for teenage girls today is that they were written with such a sense of responsibility, and I learned so much about sex through them. But I also, having also been a magazine journalist, know that that information would have been checked. It had a really clear sense of who its audience was. And I think one of the issues with the internet is that any information is available to anyone, really, whether it's the right pitched at the right level for you or not. I sort of wonder, I think of what you're saying about magazines and you, the idea of you taking home, like, you know, the idea of a porn magazine and talking to your mum about it, is your mum would have known what a magazine was on the same level as you. And I actually overheard a conversation the other day between two mums talking about their teenage kids, and they didn't seem particularly digitally literate in terms of, they were talking about Snapchat. And I just thought, oh my God, we've got this real generational split where the media is that's being consumed by teenagers isn't necessarily well understood by their parents, which is really worrying.
Yeah, I think it is, because if you don't understand what's being transmitted, how can you point out what's safe? How can you advise? How can you explain? And how can you stop judgments?
One of the things I've seen in, like, if you look at the Irish campaigns for equal marriage and for Repeal the Eighth, looking at those, some of the success seems to be talk to your grandma, be like, make it human, make it local, make it personal. And I wonder if, I feel like I'm slagging off the internet loads when it's literally my job. But I wonder if it's that distance and it's people becoming an idea and an other, rather than this is Charlie who I know, who I work with, and I know that they're great.
Yeah. I think it is that. I think the internet does two things, because the joy of the internet is it helps you find people like you, which wasn't the case before. So if you are queer and you're in a community that is heavily heterosexual and doesn't talk about queer lives, the internet has given us that chance to step out of those boundaries and find a place to be able to be you and find information. And so that, on the one side, for the internet, is incredibly important. On the other side, there is this horrific demonization that we have seen happening to any identity across the world throughout history. Again, is this idea of kind of demonizing people and of thinking that of building someone into a monster if you don't personally know or believe you don't personally know someone like that. And I think we do need to embrace that kind of localness of understanding that people who are not like our identity are everywhere, and that they don't, you know, congregate in the cities, and they don't exist in a world outside of ours. They are absolutely present and they're absolutely here. And one of the things I tried really hard to do with sex lessons, and I think I was really touched, someone wrote this a reader wrote this on in a review lately, was that I put LGBTQ plus history, I'd given it the same platform that I was giving heterosexual sex and gender identity in the same book. Because normally, you know, you'll get a book that's just LGBT history or just straight history, and there isn't a lot that crosses, that just says, look, it's all the same. It's a platform. We're all here. It all matters. It's one of the things I really hope the book does.
And how do we unpick how people saw themselves and how those identities have changed over history? Because I think it's something that it's interesting, some people kind of, they look back and apply labels, and then other people will say you can't call that person gay in that period, it wasn't relevant.
I think this is the problem of historians. And I think when you're a historian like me and you're spending your time communicating to the public about kind of all the amazing stuff that we find in archives, some people and some members of the public want that to be very black and white because they think that's how you get messages over the easiest. And history is not black and white. History really complicated, and you can look for idols and you can be looking for people just like you. They won't be, they'll be complex. You could find the greatest kind of gay out and proud icon in the past and they'll also be a massive racist. So you know, never ever simple trying to find yourself in the past. So the attitude that I took was, and I hope one, and I think, and I know it's one a lot of historians who look at the past, especially at sexual culture, also take, is if we have a specific bit of memoir, like a letter or a diary or someone saying something publicly in the press, that this is who they are. So if it's someone who's trans saying, I knew this was the wrong body for me. If it's someone who's gay saying, I love men and only men, or a lesbian saying, I love women and only women, or someone bisexual saying, I love everyone, then you can state absolutely that that is someone who conforms to what we consider to be a queer identity. If you don't, and what we have often is kind of, say, someone who is a woman who's married a man and had children, and then been known to have a number of lesbian lovers or affairs with women, a lot of people in the past and a lot of sex historians in the past would say, oh, well, then that was just a closeted lesbian. And I personally feel very much that that erases the entire identity of people who are bi. And what we need to do is be really clear that if someone states they are something, we don't argue with it. We don't have, because some people will tend to look back at the past and go, oh yeah, well, this person says, you know, that they were one thing, but clearly they're another. We don't have that right as historians. We have to go on what people say they were. And if there's ambiguity, or if we don't have that firsthand account from them about how they felt about who they were, then we have to say, well, they could be this or they could be that. We can't judge. So I think there's great desperation for people to find their queer idols in the past and hold on to them. And that makes complete sense to me, because you're trying to find your history. But we also need to let them, we can't force people into boxes just because it's easier for us. So I think we do have to have an understanding that people's sexuality and identity in the past could be ambiguous, and also that bi people existed. Hello. That's one of my biggest bugbears. We just can't let the past be this concrete, simple thing, because who on earth is?
But that actually leads me on to something else I wanted to ask you about, which was about kind of inter-community relationships through history. So was there a sense, A, of being part of a group, and B, of how those groups interacted, you know, women who are attracted to women and with men who are attracted to men or trans people?
I think we have very clear gay men, male communities. So the Molly House culture, and that's one of the things that I dig into in the book that I really loved, was kind of finding out about how the Molly Houses worked and how gay culture worked in the kind of the 17 and early 1800s, because that's fascinating. And it's also, so we've got so much record of it, so much left behind of kind of gay marriages as they perceived them, and the language that they used, and their kind of codes, and how they talked to one another, and kind of how they built their culture. And that's amazing. You know, if you want to find gay men in the past, my God, they're there. Lesbian women, oh, it's hard. It's much harder. But we have had some amazing things, like Anne Lister's coded diary. And what it, one of the things that I found looking at people in the past is lesbian women are not rarer, but they didn't form the kind of open public, more public communities that gay men did. And I think that's more with how women were restricted in their public lives, and the way that a lot of men had far more freedom in their ability to kind of travel and to do things, and women didn't really have that. So what we do find is kind of women forming their communities and their bonds at school. So if they're educated, then the chance to kind of find someone else like you in your dormitories or in your social circle is definitely present. But it does, you know, we've still got a long way to go to really fully unpick what it was like as a lesbian woman in, say, the 1800s or the 1700s. But we absolutely know they were present and they were there. If you're someone who's trans, this is where kind of the painful part of our history really sits, because often the only time we manage to find records of trans people in the past are if they're in front of courts, if they're seen as criminals. And especially in the 1500s and the 1600s, unfortunately, what happened to women or men who were trans is that if they came before a court, they were then killed as being different, as being sexually deviant. So there's kind of a couple of really sad stories in the book, which is a woman who we could identify as trans, or we could identify as someone who's a lesbian and then presents as male, so that she and her partner will just be able to travel and seen as kind of as an ordinary couple. And they use sex toys. So she's convicted of using infernal instruments, which is kind of the code for dildos or anything else, with her wife. It's not really clear if it's the woman who's kind of confessed, the wife, if it's kind of confessed this has been happening, or if they've been captured and it's been uncovered that this is, that they're two women, one of whom is presenting as a man. And so because we don't have anything from them that says exactly how they are, we can't say if this is a trans man and their wife, or if it's a lesbian couple who are presenting as a heterosexual couple to be able to live their lives. But they're burned at the stake. And it's horrifying to know that so many times our queer community has faced persecution and horror when all they were doing is living. At the same time, in the book, there are lots of really positive stories and positive examples of people living queer lives, being supported by their community. But I was really determined to show our history, you know, kind of red in tooth and claw. So the best bits and also the worst bits. And we can't hide from either of those.
How does like class impact upon this? Because one of the things I found interesting in I think I was reading Queer London by Peter Ackroyd, and I found it really interesting the way that sometimes within a queer community, you see a much bigger intersections of people from different classes mixing together. So I'm kind of interested how that's played out over time.
Well, for me, really when it's looking at the history of gay men is one of the places where we can see class coming into play the clearest. And one of the things I do in the book is with tracing kind of how the 19th century looked and treated gay men. We have this idea that Victorians absolutely hated and demonized gay men and it's awful. But actually, if you look across the 19th century, you see this amazing move from really its start to nearly the very end of acceptance and understanding and kind of trying to change the laws in support of gay men. So when we're looking at the history and how kind of how they've been perceived at the start of the 19th century, so the early 1800s, we have the last few executions of consensual gay men for sodomy. So, and when these happen in the 1830s, there's a huge backlash. And actually the magistrate who sends the last pair of consensual gay men to trial at the Old Bailey writes to the Home Secretary and states very clearly that this can't keep happening, because as far as he's concerned, the only people who are being executed for being in a consensual gay relationship are working class men, because upper class men can pay to keep their names out of it and they can pay off the authorities. And he just states very clearly, you know, for him, it's not a matter of whether or not being gay is okay. It's simply that we are demonizing working class men for what upper class men can pay their way out of a prosecution. But for him, really, this is a huge kind of class issue, and that shouldn't be happening. So if we're not going to punish upper class men, why the hell are we punishing, why are we murdering working class men simply for being gay? So and he's actually, his fight is very successful. We get rid of the death penalty for people who are in for sodomy. We get rid of a kind of the interference in consensual gay relationships. Often if a consensual gay relationship comes before, people are simply let off. They're told to kind of go away. Yes, the law hasn't changed, but if it's a consensual relationship, why on earth would we prosecute this person? Why would we put them in prison? They do prosecute people who commit assaults and attacks, but we would want that today. So I don't think it's very different. The class definitely plays a role in how gay men are seen in the 19th century. Unfortunately, by the end of the 19th century, thanks to one man, which is an MP called Henry Labouchere, to be gay is criminalised in 1885 for the very first time. Before this point, there was nothing on our statute books that criminalised gay relationships. It was only the act of sodomy, and the act of sodomy was something that could occur between a man and woman, a man and man, a woman and a woman, people and animals. You know, it was a really wide-ranging thing of which gay relationships often came under. When that's removed, we have nothing on our law books that it makes being gay criminal until 1885. And Henry Labouchere is an MP who is deeply homophobic. There's a law going through Parliament to raise the age of consent from 13 to 16. And as it's being discussed, Henry Labouchere stands up as MPs can and says, I want to add an amendment. And it's that relationships between men are disgusting and should be criminalised. And he gets the support of three MPs and it's passed into law. And that's it. It's that quick. It's that quick. And that's how easy it is for history and our laws and our society to be altered when the wrong people are in power and the right people do not stand up against them. And it's one of those moments in our history that I try to teach, if I'm ever teaching about this. This is the thing I really want my students, anyone listening or reading, to take home. Laws change so quickly, and it takes one person to change the world for everyone else. Because once it's in law, you can't, it's so much harder to get rid of it. And it's incredibly frightening to me to be able to pinpoint this absolute moment in our history where to have a gay relationship, to be a man in love with another man, whether or not you were keeping it secret at home, suddenly your entire way of life was illegal, which it never had been before that point. And Labouchere makes it really clear that it's in public or in private. So suddenly, overnight, gay people in this country, gay men in this country, had their entire way of life, their entire ability to live, erased and made criminal. And it blows my mind to think of it as literally flipping a light switch. That's and it took, you know, 80 years, 70 years for being gay to be decriminalized after this. And there was an immediate backlash to this amendment. True. Gay men especially started writing about how it shouldn't be criminalized and everything. But when you look at gay men today, I understand the fear, the horror, the hatred that comes with knowing their history changed so fast, their right to exist changed so fast and took so long to be put right.
A lot of what we've just talked about there is about how straight people in the straight mainstream can have such a huge impact on the ability of queer people to live their lives. The other thing I was interested was the kind of reverse. So how you think the mainstream and straight people have been influenced by queer people in their culture through history. Because I think now there's a sort of joke, isn't there, that culture moves through different groups and it starts with Black women and moves through kind of Black queer men, white queer men, and then white women, and then it becomes mainstream. But do we see any of that kind of effect earlier in history?
Well, I think, yeah, if you're looking at kind of, especially at looking at the words, so like I said, black queer communities in Harlem in the 1920s, these are where the words kind of for bulldyking and faggot, which we used, has been used very much as a slur, but kind of starts out as an identifying marker in the 1920s and 30s in Harlem, then gets imported into white European communities, where it gets not legitimized, but it becomes something that they then feel is theirs. And that history that connects black communities and white communities and American communities and European communities gets lost, rather than seeing it as kind of this amazing emerging thing that has heritage that starts in one place and is connected to it. And you could absolutely, I would love another historian to really dig into that, of where that decision to lose your heritage and why comes from. Because when you think about 1920s, 1930s, masculine and lesbian identities, everyone will say Radcliffe Hall, white woman, white upper class, middle class woman, writing about her lesbian butch identity. Well, what she was talking about, and yet the words that were being associated with her, came from the black from Harlem and from black culture and black community. So how did she get it? How did she know it? And why was she then the face of it? We're having exactly the same arguments today about why that happens and how wrong it is. Well, it absolutely happened in our past and in our queer communities as well. So it's clearly something we really need to address, because it's been over 100 years. So it's time.
Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about, which you mentioned earlier, was Mother Clapp and her Molly House, which was actually, finding out about Mother Clapp was the inspiration for this entire podcast. Because I was just like, you know, there have been women, and not necessarily queer women, who've been in these kind of gay male communities for much longer than I thought. And I'm interested in kind of your take on that. I've heard some people say that it was very much a financial decision for her. It was kind of expedient. But are there any other kind of Mother Claps we should know about?
Well, I love that story and I love that history, and it's been really well done. So I don't look at Mother Clapp in the book. I look very much at Molly Houses that are male run and male oriented and kind of with gay men. But the crossover between women and men and queer communities supporting one another, and people from outside supporting people in the queer community, is absolutely current across our history. And I think when you look at kind of heterosexual women's role in that, I disagree absolutely that anyone could paint something as purely being financial. But there is something that goes alongside that, which is an understanding that everyone should have a place that's theirs and be free in it. And I think women in the past understand that far better. I think heterosexual women in the past understand that far better than heterosexual men, because heterosexual women had to find a place to be free because they were not allowed to be free in other places, in public places. So I think we do see a lot of heterosexual women acting as kind of queer gatekeepers or queer protectors, because they understand how important those spaces are. And that's, we don't tend to allow heterosexual women to have that role at the moment, because we're demonizing them a lot, understandably, in many ways, for things that have happened. But they have also played a role as well, and we can't ignore that history, and we can't deny that so many heterosexual women, especially in the AIDS crisis as well, were that bridge between the queer community and the straight community, to give, it's what we talked about earlier, making it local, making it human, helping people to connect to the humanity of what someone was going through, rather than seeing them as another, rather than seeing them as something to be demonized and ignored. And that doesn't mean that heterosexual women have got things right. Some of them can be absolutely horrific towards the queer community. But I do think we need to stop, it's this thing that we're doing today where we're putting everyone in a box and we're not allowing anyone to get out of them. And it's just so dangerous because it's not real.
Yeah. And I think looking back as well, you know, a lot of people who, there's a lot of discourse around, you know, straight women in gay clubs and, you know, is this their space and taking up room. And, you know, I just look back to when I first started going to gay clubs, when I identified as straight. And if I hadn't had the grace extended to me to be made welcome there, what would I have missed knowing about myself? And I think that ability to, you know, help people explore who they are and the different settings they might find themselves in is really important. And I think it does involve grace and understanding on both sides. And I think that's difficult when it feels like the physical spaces we're all allowed are shrinking. But I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's quite sad that that need for freedom and safety, even for straight women through history, is still super present. The other thing I wanted to ask is to nominate another Dorothy. So someone else I should speak to or do an episode about. So I'm defining that for the record as a woman who's queer or straight, who has had an impact on queer culture. And it can include historical Dorothys.
Oh, so. You know, well, I know this isn't what you said, but you should really do one on Oscar Wilde because Oscar Wilde is bi.
Hmm.
And no one talks about that because he's such a gay idol, and he is a gay idol, but he also was passionate for his wife and loved his wife. And what you should do is you should talk to a historian who wants to talk about that.
All right, brilliant.
That's who my Dorothy would be.
I honestly could have talked to Dr. Adele for hours, and now I really want to go and do that postgrad MA into gender and sexuality. What can I say? I'm a big nerd and I love learning things. As ever, don't forget to tweet us and let us know what you thought of the episode and which Dorothy or friend of Dorothy you think I should talk to next. When we next come to your podcast feeds, we're trying something a little bit different with a panel conversation recorded live of brilliant debut female authors all about queer representation in books. See you then. And don't forget, if you've got time and the inclination, we would love you to rate us 5 stars on your podcast app. This episode of The Dorothy Project featured Dr. Fern Riddell as our guest. It was hosted by Alice Beverton-Palmer and produced by Laura Blake.